New Zealand's nugget. He went on to express his great sorrow at the prospect of quitting the place so soon, and assured the voting public that he would take the best interests of the common digger with him to the new capital city the following month, where he would serve his term in Parliament as a faithful Westland man. After Lauderback's speech, the magistrate shook his hand very warmly, and the commissioner led three rounds of huzzah. On the 12th of April, the walls of George Shepherd's jailhouse and asylum went up at last. The felons, Anna and Emery included, had been transferred from the temporary quarters at the police camp to the new building upon the terrace of Sea View, where Mrs. George was already installed as matron. Since Ah Suk's death, she had been kept very busy, hemming blankets, sewing uniforms, cooking, tabulating stores, and making up weekly rations of tobacco and salt. She was seen, if possible, even less frequently than before. She spent her evenings in the Sea View graveyard, and her nights in the residence alone. On the 16th, Francis Carver and Lydia Wells were finally married, before a crowd that, as the society pages of the West Coast Times had it, befit, in dress, number and demeanour, the marriage of a widowed bride. The day after the wedding, the groom received a large cash payment from the Garrity Group, with which his creditors were paid in full. The last of the copper plating was pried from Godspeed's hull, and the bones of the ship were given up at long last for salvage. He had ended his board at the Palace Hotel, and was now installed at the Wayfarer's Fortune with his wife. Over this time, a great many men had tramped up the switchback trail to the terrace at Sea View in order to beg an interview with Emery Staines. Cowell Devlin, on the jailer's strict instruction, turned each man away, assuring them that, yes, Staines was alive, and that, yes, he was recuperating from a very grave illness, and that, yes, he would be released from custody in due course, pending the verdict of the magistrate's court. The only exception the chaplain made was for Te Rau Taufare, to whom Staines had become, over the course of the past month, extraordinarily attached. Taufare rarely stayed long at the jailhouse, but his visits had such an advantageous effect upon Staines' mood and health that Devlin soon began to look forward to them also. Staines, Devlin discovered, was a sweet-natured, credulous lad, ready with a smile and full of naive affection for the foibles of the world around him. He spoke little of the long weeks of his absence, repeating only that he had been very unwell and he was very glad to have returned. When Devlin asked, cautiously, whether he remembered encountering Walter Moody aboard Godspeed, he only frowned and shook his head. His memory of that period was very incomplete, made up, as far as Devlin could tell, of dreamlike impressions, sensations, and snatches of light. He could not remember boarding a ship, and nor could he remember a shipwreck, though he seemed to recall being washed up on the beach, coughing seawater, both arms wrapped around a cask of salt beef. He remembered approaching Crosby Wells' cottage. He remembered passing a party of diggers sitting around a fire. He remembered leaves and running water. He remembered the rotten hull of an abandoned canoe, and a steep-sided gorge, and the red eye of a weka. He remembered nightly dreams about the patterns of the tarot, and gold-lined corsets, and a fortune in a flour sack hidden beneath a bed. "It's all a dreadful blur," he said. "I must have walked out into the night and got lost in the bush somehow, and after that I couldn't find my way back again. What a good job it was that old Te Rau found me when he did."
"And yet it would have been much better if he had found you sooner," Devlin said, still speaking cautiously. "If you had returned but 3 days earlier, your claims would not have been seized. You've lost all your assets, Mr. Staines."
Staines seemed very unconcerned by this.
"There's always more gold to be had," he said. "Money's only money, and it does one good to be out of pocket every once in a while. In any case, I've a nest egg up in the Arahura Valley, stashed away. Thousands and thousands of pounds. As soon as I've recovered, I'll go and dig it up."
This, naturally, took a great while to straighten out. On the third week of April, the petty session schedule was published in the West Coast Times, The charges levelled against Mr. Emery Staines are as follows. Firstly, the falsification of the January 1866 quarterly report. Secondly, the theft of ore lawfully submitted by Mr. John Long Quay against the gold mine Aurora, since discovered in the possession of the late Mr. Crosby Wells of the Arahura Valley. Thirdly, dereliction of duty to claims, mines, and other responsibilities, the period of absence being in excess of 8 weeks. Hearing scheduled for Thursday the 27th of April at the Resident Magistrates Court, 1 p.m., before His Honour, Mr. Justice Kemp. Devlin, reading this over his Saturday morning coffee, made for the Crown at once.
"Yes, I saw it," said Moody, who was breakfasting on kippers and toast.
"You must understand the significance of the charges."
"Of course. I shall hope for a quick hearing, as will many others, I expect."
Moody poured his guest a cup of coffee, sat back, and waited politely for Devlin to announce the reason for his visit. The chaplain placed his hand upon the tabletop, palm upward.
"You have legal training, Mr. Moody," he said, "and from what I know of your character, you have a fair mind. That is to say, you're not partial, one way or another. You know the facts of this case as a lawyer ought. From all sides, I mean."
Moody frowned.
"Yes, indeed," he said, "which means that I know very well that the gold in Mr. Wells' cottage never came from the Aurora in the first place. It does not belong to Mr. Staines, whichever way one looks at it. You can't be asking me to stand up in court, Reverend."
"That is precisely what I am asking," said Devlin. "There is a shortage of solicitors in Hokitika, and yours is a better mind than most."
Moody was incredulous.
"This is a civil court," he said. "Do you imagine me performing some sort of grand exposure of the whole story, dragging every last one of you into it, not to mention Lauderback and Shepherd and Carver and Lydia Wells?"
"Lydia Carver, you ought to say now."
"Forgive me, Lydia Carver," said Moody. "Reverend, I do not see how I could be of any use at all at a court of petty sessions. Nor do I see who would benefit from a merciless exposure of the whole business. The fortune in the dresses, the blackmail, Lauderback's personal history, everything."
He was thinking about the bastard Crosby Wells.
"I am not advocating for a merciless exposure," the chaplain said. "I am asking you to consider acting as Miss Wetherill's counsel."